Our challenge is to gradually restart the economy without restarting the pandemic.
Quebec Premier François Legault becoming the latest provincial leader to talk about gradually getting life back to normal. It's a tentative first phase for the hardest hit province. It comes as the federal government updates its modeling for the spread of the disease and preaches continued caution. More than a month in, if what you're hearing from politicians feels incremental, well, follow the science. That's what Canada's chief public health officer will tell you, and you'll be hearing from Dr. Theresa Tam tonight on The World at 6. Also on the program, you'll hear why some say government financial assistance during the pandemic might be having unintended consequences. And we'll have the latest thinking on COVID-19 and kids. There is other news, including this update from Nova Scotia RCMP.
At this stage of the investigation, we have not uncovered any information that the police had knowledge that he had possessed these vehicles or that he had possessed a replica police vehicle.
Welcome to the program. I'm Susan Bonner. In a moment, Tom Perry will be here to go over the latest federal COVID-19 projections, but we'll start with James Murray. Hello, James.
Hello, Susan. Steep climbs in new recorded cases, especially in two provinces tonight. 1,400 new cases of COVID-19 documented across the country. Quebec alone is tracking 775 new cases. Ontario, 525 new cases after slight declines for the past few days. More than 15,000 since the beginning of the pandemic in Ontario, and to deal with that, the province has postponed about 52,000 surgeries. Today, Ontario's health minister says lives were lost as people waited.
It has been estimated that approximately 35 people may have passed away because their surgeries were not performed. That's not something any of us want to hear. Certainly was not intended because the best medical decisions were made. I don't want to call it collateral damage because they are deaths.
But Christine Elliott says thousands of lives have been saved. The annual day of mourning for workers killed on the job was front of mind for many today. Flags were lowered, vigils were held. Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister praised healthcare workers who are fighting COVID-19 every day. Quebec's premier says some businesses will be allowed to reopen as early as next week outside of Montreal, starting with manufacturing, construction, and stores that aren't in malls. Nearly 200,000 people could be back to work. BC says it isn't ready to open schools just yet. The province's education minister, Susan, says he's still studying how other jurisdictions are doing it safely.
And James, speaking of safely, there was an image for the history books today, courtesy of House of Commons employees.
Well, it was a sight to see, a sort of virtual parliament with MPs and the speaker appearing in boxes on a screen. And anyone who's taken part in a Zoom meeting lately can guess how well the virtual parliament went.
So we'll continue.
Merci,
we have another point of order.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you,
Mrs. Rempel. We'll go into Monsieur Reyes.
It went on and on like that. According to Johns Hopkins University, the United States has passed the million case mark with more than 58,000 deaths, about the same number of deaths the U.S. felt in some 18 years of war in Vietnam. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence drawing criticism today for a visit to the Mayo Clinic. Photos of the event show everyone in the room wearing a mask. Except Pence, the VP heads a task force, Susan, that recommends that all Americans wear masks.
Thank you, James. That is our James Murray in Toronto.
Based on the best data available, this is an updated picture of where we think we are right now and where we think things will go from here.
And where Canada goes, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says, depends on how we open up the country. Today, his government released new guidelines of how to lift restrictions, along with new modeling projections. Tom Perry takes us through the latest numbers.
We are making clear progress.
A good news message with a strong note of caution from Canada's top physician. Dr. Theresa Tam releasing new projections showing the trend lines on COVID-19 moving in the right direction.
Last time I presented this graph to you, Canada's confirmed case count was doubling every 3 to 5 days. At this time, the doubling The number of cases is doubling at a rate of every 16 days.
While slowing, the numbers are still rising. Canada has had roughly 50,000 cases of COVID-19 and nearly 3,000 deaths. By next week, Tam says those numbers could rise to nearly 67,000 cases and almost 3,900 fatalities.
It is important to recognize that models are not crystal balls and cannot predict what will happen.
Tam says much depends on how Canadians behave, whether they remain on guard against the virus. That message echoed today by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Here's the bottom line. The measures we've taken so far are working. In fact, in many parts of the country, the curve has flattened, but we're not out of the woods yet.
The new figures show COVID-19 hitting some parts of the country harder than others. Ontario and Quebec account for more than 80% of all cases. The numbers also confirm the devastating impact on senior centres and long-term care facilities, which have been linked to 79% of all COVID-19 deaths. Despite all that, some provinces are talking about lifting some restrictions on people and businesses.
So we think that in the population in general, it's quite under control.
Quebec Premier François Legault says some stores in the province will be allowed to reopen next month after announcing yesterday that daycares and elementary schools would also resume.
We don't want to put our kids at risk. That's really what it comes down to.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford moving more slowly, every province proceeding at its own pace. Along with new projections, the federal government today released a set of guidelines agreed to by the provinces and territories. Conditions in areas like testing and healthcare capacity that need to be in place before they start to lift restrictions. Acknowledging that while the numbers may be moving in the right direction now, that can always change. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
Now that the disease has been around for months and has spread to more than 180 countries and regions, there are growing calls for a review of the way the World Health Organization has led the fight against it. Even Canada's chief public health officer supports it when things are under control. Dr. Theresa Tam cautions not all of the criticism leveled at the WHO is deserved. Here she is giving an exclusive interview to the CBC's chief political correspondent, Rosemary Barton.
I think it's a very difficult job to do, quite honestly.
Dr. Theresa Tam is well aware that there are growing demands around the world for a full review of how the World Health Organization first responded to COVID-19 and whether China held back data. Tam says she is not convinced the WHO could have gotten more information anyway.
The estimations of how transmissible the virus was and how severe it was unclear at the start. And I think most of my colleagues, some of whom are much more experienced than me, didn't quite know what the situation was.
She accepts that mistakes may have been made and for that reason supports some kind of review of how the pandemic was managed.
I think the spirit of the IHR is that every country has to share information. So it's not just up to the WHO, it's all member states actually have to do what we said we were going to do.
Right.
And so so there'll be lessons learned from both sides.
Tam has been attacked for her role at the WHO, sometimes in racist terms. Yet she says she remains focused on her job and says her role as a contributing scientist at the WHO is vitally important to helping Canada understand how to respond. She says science is also what is guiding her advice on how the public health restrictions are eased in this country. As more provinces lay out plans, Tam says it will be about society finding ways to make it work.
You stagger people coming in so that you're not just your work shifts, but maybe your public transport means that you're not all crowded at the same rush hour. Those are the kind of ideas that will allow, I think, some of those measures to be eased off of it.
Canada's top doctor says while signs are encouraging, we are at a key tipping point. And if the reopening of the economy happens too quickly, a surge could still happen, particularly after the summer.
I'm still planning ahead to what happens in the next winter. Season when it's not just living with COVID-19. You're going to get influenza, you're going to get the other viruses. And so being able to prepare for that is part of the new normal as well.
The country is still not out of the first wave of this virus, and already Dr. Tam is planning for the next one. Rosemary Barton, CBC News, Ottawa.
In just one day, more than 44,000 businesses have already applied for the federal wage subsidy program during this pandemic lockdown. But some employers are having a hard time getting staff to return to work because, they say, the federal benefit for workers is too generous. The CBC's Karen Pauls has more.
Winnipeg restaurant owner Tony Sawicki is putting up signs, letting customers know he's open for takeout and delivery. He's also gearing up for a hopeful return to eat-in service.
Planning and reacting and trying to figure out how to pay the bills.
Sawicki is trying to rehire the serving staff and cooks he had to lay off, but many are collecting the Canada Emergency Response Benefit worth $500 a week for up to 16 weeks. And he says they don't want to come back to work yet.
The employees that I do have are all jealous of their peers sitting at home collecting $2,000, which was more money than they probably even made while they were working two shifts a week, right?
It's not just restaurants.
I have not been able to hire anybody new yet.
Shelley Ettinger's company usually manufactures clothes, but it pivoted to make masks and gowns for healthcare workers. She knows some parents don't have childcare, and she understands the health and safety concerns. So she adjusted the hours and workspace to respect physical distancing.
It's really frustrating that employees have the option to not come into work when we need them. I do feel like it's being used a little bit.
We have created ourselves a problem.
Last week, New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs said Ottawa rolled out the benefit without getting feedback from business.
And we have people at home that have chosen not to come back to work or not able. In case they're not able, that's fine. But in the case of choosing not to come back to work, that's a problem.
Toronto labor lawyer Howard Levitt says employees need to understand they can collect CERB and still earn up to $1,000 a month. Meanwhile, business owners can give their employees an ultimatum.
They can say to employees, the workplace is safe, there's a job here for you to do, and if you don't come back, we're going to terminate your employment for not returning to the workplace, issue a new record of employment, and you'll be cut off of CERB and EI too.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has repeatedly said the CERB is meant to support Canadians when they need it, but it's only a short-term fix.
Ideally, people will keep their connections with their workplaces so that they can know that they have a job to return to.
Back in Winnipeg, Tony Sawicki hopes he won't have to issue any ultimatums.
Well, in a month and 2 weeks, whatever it is, that's when we hit the phone calls and finding out who's coming and who's not.
Karen Pauls, CBC News, Winnipeg.
COVID-19 is not hitting children as hard as adults, and it's not affecting them in the same ways either. Now, Canadian pediatricians are warning about one particularly unusual symptom. Health reporter Christine Birak has that story.
Ready? Children pick up plenty of germs. This coronavirus is no exception. But when compared with adults, their bodies don't react to it the same way. Dina Kulik is a pediatric emergency room doctor.
It hasn't been really making children very sick.
In a study set to be published in the journal Pediatrics, Chinese researchers found about 6% of children infected with the virus became severe or critically ill. In adults, it's nearly 20%. Doctors aren't sure why, but suspect children may have a different immune response. Still, Dr. Kulik says if children have the virus, they can also spread it.
I'm much more concerned about their parents and our parents' parents.
As some provinces prepare to send young children back to school, even the Prime Minister is expressing concerns.
I'd want to know what the school was planning on doing, whether the desks were going to be properly spaced. These are all details.
But a recent review published in the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health points out COVID-19 modeling studies predict school closures alone would prevent only 2 to 4% of deaths. Australia is now pushing to send children back to class. Dr. Jeffrey Pernica is the head of pediatric infectious disease at McMaster University.
COVID-19, in contrast to just about every other respiratory virus disease, seems to be spread less by children than by adults.
Pediatricians are sharing a lot of information globally in an effort to stay ahead of this virus. But Dr. Pernica says talk of a rare but severe inflammatory disease seen in some children in Europe should be taken with a grain of salt.
We don't know how many cases there are. We don't know if it's really an increase from what you would expect, and we certainly don't know if it's linked to COVID.
Pediatricians are, however, looking for a condition dubbed COVID toes. It looks similar to frostbite. It doesn't warrant a trip to the ER, but it may be a sign that a child has the virus. In serious COVID-19 cases, doctors say children do show the same symptoms as adults: fever, coughing, and trouble breathing. Christine Birak, CBC News, Toronto.
Some provinces have already set dates to reopen schools. Others are relying on parents to keep up their children's education for the foreseeable future. That's an ongoing challenge, because whether those parents are still going to the workplace or trying to work from home, many are discovering that online homeschooling is no substitute for the real thing. Deanna Sumanak-Johnson reports.
I had no energy for hours afterwards.
Monica Bellier should be good at both staying calm and teaching. She's a yoga instructor. But none of that helped when she tried to tackle distance learning with her 8-year-old son, Ben.
It was just like pulling teeth.
Bellier says she just could not get Ben, who had some problems focusing in class, to concentrate on assignments at home.
He would literally just like slump in his chair and be like, I can't do this. I don't know what's happening. I don't want to do this. I'm like, can you look at the screen?
So she decided to pull the plug on distance learning. A tough decision, though one that in Ontario currently carries no repercussions to Ben's academic career. He will still move on to the next grade. Author and journalist Russell Smith has also felt the frustration of trying to be a dad to a 10-year-old and a teacher at once.
Even getting him to sit and read a book was actually quite difficult. I guess I didn't have, as a parent, the authority that a teacher did, but he just didn't have the structure, and he just didn't.
Smith is a single father who shares custody with his son's mother.
And on the days when I'm with him, I simply do not do any work of my own. I'm simply a full-time caregiver.
Neither Smith nor Monica Bellier blame their kids' teachers for any of their homeschooling issues. At least part of the problem with distance learning is that teachers can't be as available to answer each student's questions in real time as they would be in a classroom. And Tina Rapke, an expert in education from York University, says parents should go just as easy on themselves.
And so I think actually following children's ideas, even if we think that we know better and we want them to learn something else, is actually a way to engage children and have them interested in what they're doing.
Russell Smith is doing just that. In addition to his school assignments, his son is currently researching a report on alien abduction stories, something the father and son can bond over. As for Monica Bellier,
at least now, though, that we're, you know, with my son not having this dreaded time of day, it feels manageable.
Tough decisions made in tough times when the work, life, and school balance seems more elusive than ever. Deanna Sumanak-Johnson, CBC News, Toronto.
A few other stories are in the news tonight. We'll start with Fort McMurray. It's facing its worst flooding since 1934, a nearly 25-kilometer-long ice jam on the Athabasca River has swamped streets and displaced thousands of people. It appears to have eased overnight, but officials say conditions could change without warning, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. Rafi Bujakanian has the latest.
I loaded up what I could grab.
Brad Orr left home fast after officials knocked on his door and told him to get out. He says downtown Fort McMurray's appearance changed almost as quickly.
What was a little puddle only a couple hours ago is too deep to drive a truck through.
A barrage of chunks of ice more than twice the length of football fields is blocking the flow of the Athabasca River. While more than 12,000 have had to leave their homes in the Fort McMurray area, it's not stopping some from volunteering.
We're still going to continue doing what we can every single day.
Hani Ali owns Four Seasons Moving. He's putting his trucks at the disposal of anyone who needs to pack their belongings or deliver goods to evacuees.
We're just collecting food, collecting items.
Yesterday, the municipality's mayor was asking for more help.
I would like to have seen nothing better than the military used or dynamite used to get can move us past this situation.
But Don Scott says provincial emergency experts told him that's not a good idea.
Because the ICAM is so large, military dynamiting it or using CF-18s would not be an effective tool.
Meanwhile, the province is dealing with another emergency too. Peace River, further west, has an ice jam problem nearly twice as long as the Athabasca's.
There is no reasonable engineering solution to unlock the ice jams at this point.
Still, Environment Minister Jason Nixon says the government is doing what it can, supplying the region with sandbags, portable dams, helping with setting up evacuees. As for the rest,
we have to rely on warm weather to soften the ice.
But no matter how long the situation lasts, Brad Orr, who also abandoned house and home in 2016 due to the wildfire, says in the end, he'll be okay.
I'm experienced at evacuating now, and I made it okay last time. I'm sure I'll make it okay this time.
Officials are hoping sunny and hot weather tomorrow will help make that happen sooner rather than later. Rafi Bujikanian, CBC News, Edmonton.
In Nova Scotia, RCMP investigators have put together more pieces of the timeline from last week's mass shooting. They say they've now accounted for the several hours that elapsed after the killer started a rampage that took 22 lives. Thomas Dagler reports.
Amid late April wind, snow, hail, and rain, RCMP investigators continue their work in Portapique, where the rampage began 10 days ago. Police are still examining five crime scenes, and they provided an update late this afternoon.
There's still much more work to do in this investigation, but we've made significant progress to date.
Superintendent Darren Campbell is now filling in two key parts previously left blank in the timeline of the shooter's killing spree. To begin with, he says the first 911 call came in just after 10 o'clock on the Saturday night, and officers arrived by 10:26. 9 minutes later, a witness spotted a car driving through a field, and investigators now believe that was the gunman taking off. Video evidence suggests the killer drove to an industrial area in DeBert, 26 kilometers away, and that's where he spent the night.
We've searched that area thoroughly, but we are making a plea to anyone in that area, if they had seen anything suspicious, to please contact the police.
The RCMP also continue their focus on the gunman's mock Mountie cruiser and uniform. They acknowledge he was a collector of police memorabilia and had gear from several agencies. That included a real Mountie shirt and pants with a yellow stripe worn during his rampage. The RCMP say they have no indication any former member of the force helped him obtain any equipment.
We have yet to confirm exactly where or how he obtained these uniform pieces. This is an important aspect of our investigation, and this will take some time.
Campbell says last fall, the gunman purchased the vehicle used in the attacks and then added the police-style lights and RCMP decals. He didn't hide the car from others, but the RCMP say they had no knowledge of it. They've confirmed among the 22 victims, 8 bodies were pulled from burned-out buildings and vehicles, but how many died of gunshot wounds is unclear. Investigators are working with the Border Services Agency, as well as contacts in the United States, to determine how the killer got his weapons, most of which were obtained outside this country. Thomas Dagg, CBC News, Toronto.
Post Media is closing 15 community papers across Manitoba and in parts of Ontario. In a letter to employees, the company's president blamed the economic effects of the pandemic. Post Media is also laying off 80 employees as part of its belt tightening. The company says it will look into providing some online coverage to the affected communities. You are listening to The World at 6 from CBC News. I'm Susan Bonner. You can hear The World at 6 and other CBC radio programs wherever you are. Just download the CBC Listen app. One of the key elements in fighting the coronavirus pandemic is information. And many countries are fighting in the dark. Their testing levels too low to be useful. In Ecuador, confirmed cases more than doubled in a single day as delayed results were released. The country has one of the highest death tolls in the region. And as Kim Brunhuber reports, even the president admits it probably doesn't yet reflect the awful reality.
In Ecuador's largest city, the dead no longer litter the streets. Sanitation teams have now collected the hundreds of cadavers left on sidewalks and doorways. So many coronavirus victims, they're being buried in cardboard caskets.
It's very demoralizing, to say the least.
Dr. Jose Suarez is at the intersection of the crisis. He studies disease and public health at the University of California, San Diego, and he grew up in Ecuador. His parents are safe in the capital, Quito, but for his relatives in Guayas province, home to 70% of Ecuador's coronavirus cases, the situation is much more precarious.
Many of the friends' grandparents have been dying. So the situation in that particular province is really as bad as it's been portrayed.
Due to a lack of testing in the country, the death toll due to coronavirus isn't yet known, but the number of dead over the last month and a half, more than 7,500, was seven times the yearly average. There are already grim lessons being learned from the situation in Ecuador. The first, distancing laws don't matter if people don't follow them.
The issue is the compliance.
People cannot afford to stay in their houses if they have no income.
Alexandra Moncada is the director of CARE Ecuador in Quito. She says in developing countries, social distancing can't happen without government support.
If our governors don't have clear messages, it's more difficult to ensure a rapid overcome of the situation.
Ecuador may be just the tip of the iceberg. Without more screening, other developing countries may be doing even worse. They just don't know it.
The moment you account for screening, you start seeing that Bolivia really becomes a big outlier. It's 12 times worse, the mortality there, than it is in Ecuador. So it's very hard to compare.
Experts say the infection rate in the region isn't expected to peak for weeks. Suarez says unless leaders learn from Ecuador, it could mean more bodies in the streets, more cardboard coffins. Kim Brunhuber, CBC News, Los Angeles.
While that terrible situation unfolds and countries everywhere long for normal, there is a place that has achieved a comfortable measure of it. As we go tonight, we want to give you a hopeful glimpse of one possible future, courtesy of New Zealand. Shops opened today, and at cafes in Auckland, people are loving their little sips of normal.
Very exciting. It's been long 4 weeks without coffee.
Oh, amazing. It's never tasted better.
So stoked.
Honestly, it's so good to have a coffee, like
the first real coffee.
While things are starting to reopen, physical distancing is still required, and people are being asked to work from home if they can. And although New Zealand seems confident it has things under control, three new cases were confirmed today. New Zealand has reported about 1,500 COVID-19 cases during the pandemic. That's it for the World at 6 for this Tuesday, April the 28th. I'm Susan Bonner. Thanks for listening. As It Happens is next. Good night.